It's not professional, but it's very delightful. Observing that he slightly faltered, and comprehending that, in the goodness of his heart, he was fearful of giving me some pain by what he'd said, I expressed my concurrence with a heartiness that evidently relieved and pleased him greatly. "But then," said Traddles, "our domestic arrangements are, to say the truth, quite unprofessional altogether, my dear Copperfield. Even Sophie's being here is unprofessional, and we have no other place of abode. We've put to sea in a cockboat, but we're quite prepared to rough it. And Sophie's an extraordinary manager. You'd be surprised how those girls are stowed away. I'm sure I hardly know how it's done." "Are many of the young ladies with you?" I inquired. "The eldest, the beauty, is here," said Traddles in a low, confidential voice. "Caroline. And Sarah's here. The one I mentioned to you as having something the matter with her spine, you know. Immensely better. And the two youngest that Sophie educated are with us, and Louise's here." "Indeed!" cried I. "Yes," said Traddles. "Now, the whole set, I mean the chambers, is only three rooms. But Sophie arranges for the girls in the most wonderful way, and they sleep as comfortably as possible. Three in that room," said Traddles, pointing, "two in that." I couldn't help glancing round in search of the accommodation remaining for Mr. and Mrs. Traddles. Traddles understood me. "Well," said Traddles, "we are prepared to rough it, as I said just now, and we did improvise a bed last week upon the floor here. But there's a little room in the roof, a very nice room when you're up there, which Sophie papered herself to surprise me, and that's our room at present. It's a capital little gypsy sort of place. There's quite a view from it." "And you are happily married at last, my dear Traddles," said I. "How rejoiced I am!" "Thank you, my dear Copperfield," said Traddles, as we shook hands once more. "Yes, I am as happy as it's possible to be." "There's your old friend, you see," said Traddles, nodding triumphantly at the flower pots and stand, "and there's the table with the marble top. All the other furniture is plain and serviceable, you perceive, and as to plate, Lord bless you, we haven't so much as a teaspoon." "All to be earned," said I cheerfully. "Exactly so," replied Traddles, "all to be earned. Of course we have something in the shape of teaspoons, because we stir our tea, but they're Britannia metal. The silver will be the brighter when it comes," said I. "The very thing we say," cried Traddles. "You see, my dear Copperfield," falling again into the low, confidential tone, "after I had delivered my argument in Do Dem Jipes versus Wigsall, which did me great service with the profession, I went down into Devonshire and had some serious conversation in private with the Reverend Horace. I dwelt upon the fact that Sophie, who I do assure you, Copperfield, is the dearest girl—" "I'm certain she is," said I. "She is indeed," rejoined Traddles. "But I'm afraid I'm wandering from the subject. Did I mention the Reverend Horace?" "You said that you dwelt upon the fact." "True. Upon the fact that Sophie and I had been engaged for a long period, and that Sophie, with the permission of her parents, was more than content to take me. In short," said Traddles, with his old frank smile, "on our present Britannia metal footing." "Very well. I then proposed to the Reverend Horace, who is a most excellent clergyman, Copperfield, and ought to be a bishop, or at least ought to have enough to live upon without pinching himself, that if I could turn the corner, say, of £250 in 1 year, and could see my way pretty clearly to that or something better next year, and could plainly furnish a little place like this besides, then, and in that case, Sophie and I should be united. I took the liberty of representing that we'd been patient for a good many years, and that the circumstance of Sophie's being extraordinarily useful at home ought not to operate with her affectionate parents against her establishment in life, don't you see?" "Certainly it ought not," said I. "I'm glad you think so, Copperfield," rejoined Traddles, "because, without any imputation on the Reverend Horace, I do think parents, and brothers and so forth, are sometimes rather selfish in such cases. Well, I also pointed out that my most earnest desire was, to be useful to the family. And that if I got on in the world and anything should happen to him, I refer to the Reverend Horace, I understand, said I, or to Mrs. Crewler, it would be the utmost gratification of my wishes to be a parent to the girls. He replied in a most admirable manner, exceedingly flattering to my feelings, and undertook to obtain the consent of Mrs. Crewler to this arrangement. They had a dreadful time of it with her. It mounted from her legs into her chest, and then into her head. What mounted? I asked. Her grief, replied Traddles with a serious look. Her feelings, generally. As I mentioned on a former occasion, she is a very superior woman, but has lost the use of her limbs. Whatever occurs to harass her usually settles in her legs, but on this occasion it mounted to the chest, and then to the head, and, in short, pervaded the whole system in a most alarming manner. However, they brought her through it by unremitting and affectionate attention, and we were married yesterday 6 weeks. You have no idea what a monster I felt, Copperfield, when I saw the whole family crying and fainting away in every direction. Mrs. Crewler couldn't see me before we left, couldn't forgive me then for depriving her of her child. But she's a good creature, and has done so since. I had a delightful letter from her only this morning. And in short, my dear friend, said I, you feel as blessed as you deserve to feel. Ah! That's your partiality, laughed Traddles. But indeed I am in a most enviable state. I work hard. We law insatiably. I get up at 5 every morning and don't mind it at all. I hide the girls in the daytime and make merry with them in the evening. And I assure you I'm quite sorry that they're going home on Tuesday, which is the day before the first day of Michaelmas term. But here, said Traddles, breaking off in his confidence and speaking aloud, are the girls. Mr. Copperfield, Miss Crewler, Miss Sarah, Miss Louisa, Margaret, and Lucy. They were a perfect nest of roses. They looked so wholesome and fresh. They were all pretty, and Miss Caroline was very handsome. But there was a loving, cheerful, fireside quality in Sophie's bright looks, which was better than that, and which assured me that my friend had chosen well. We all sat round the fire, while the sharp boy, who I now divined had lost his breath in putting the papers out, cleared them away again and produced the tea-things. After that, he retired for the night, shutting the outer door upon us with a bang. Mrs. Traddles, with perfect pleasure and composure beaming from her household eyes, having made the tea, then quietly made the toast as she sat in a corner by the fire. She'd seen Agnes, she told me, while she was toasting. Tom had taken her down into Kent for a wedding trip, and there she'd seen my aunt, too. And both my aunt and Agnes were well, and they had all talked of nothing but me. Tom had never had me out of his thoughts, she really believed, all the time I'd been away. Tom was the authority for everything. Tom was evidently the idol of her life, never to be shaken on his pedestal by any commotion, always to be believed in and done homage to with the whole faith of her heart, come what might. The deference which both she and Traddles showed towards the beauty pleased me very much. I don't know that I thought it very reasonable, but I thought it very delightful, and essentially a part of their character. If Traddles ever for an instant missed the teaspoons that were still to be won, I have no doubt it was when he handed the beauty her tea. If his sweet-tempered wife could have got up any self-assertion against anyone, I'm satisfied it could only have been because she was the beauty's sister. A few slight indications of a rather petted and capricious manner, which I observed in the beauty, were manifestly considered by Traddles and his wife as her birthright and natural endowment. If she'd been born a queen bee and they labouring bees, they couldn't have been more satisfied of that. But their self-forgetfulness charmed me. Their pride in these girls, and their submission of themselves to all their whims, was the pleasantest little testimony to their own worth I could have desired to see. If Traddles were addressed as a darling once in the course of that evening, and besought to bring something here, or carry something there, or take something up, or put something down, or find something, or fetch something. He was so addressed by one or other of his sisters-in-law at least 12 times in an hour. Neither could they do anything without Sophie. Somebody's hair fell down, and nobody but Sophie could put it up. Somebody forgot how a particular tune went, and nobody but Sophie could hum that tune right. Somebody wanted to recall the name of a place in Devonshire, and only Sophie knew it. Something was wanted to be written home, and Sophie alone could be trusted to write before breakfast in the morning. Somebody broke down in a piece of knitting, and no one but Sophie was able to put the defaulter in the right direction. They were entire mistresses of the place, and Sophie and Traddles waited on them.
This ends side one of cassette 26. Please turn the cassette over and start side two at the same point.
How many children Sophie could have taken care of in her time, I can't imagine. But she seemed to be famous for knowing every sort of song that ever was addressed to a child in the English tongue. And she sang dozens to order with the clearest little voice in the world, one after another, every sister issuing directions for a different tune, and the beauty generally striking in last, so that I was quite fascinated. The best of all was that in the midst of their exactions, all the sisters had a great tenderness and respect both for Sophie and Traddles. I'm sure when I took my leave, and Traddles was coming out to walk with me to the coffee house, I thought I had never seen an obstinate head of hair, or any other head of hair, rolling about in such a shower of kisses. Altogether, it was a scene I couldn't help dwelling on with pleasure for a long time after I got back, and had wished Traddles good night. If I had beheld a thousand roses blowing in a top set of chambers in that withered Gray's Inn, they couldn't have brightened it half so much. The idea of those Devonshire girls, among the dry law stationers and the attorneys' offices, and of the tea and toast and children's songs in that grim atmosphere of punts and parchment, red tape, dusty wafers, ink jars, brief and draft paper, law reports, writs, declarations, and bills of costs, seemed almost as pleasantly fanciful as if I had dreamt that the Sultan's famous family had been admitted on the roll of attorneys and had brought the talking bird, the singing tree, and the golden water into Gray's Inn Hall. Somehow I found that I had taken leave of Traddles for the night and come back to the coffee house with a great change in my despondency about him. I began to think he would get on in spite of all the many orders of chief waiters in England. Drawing a chair before one of the coffee-room fires to think about him at my leisure, I gradually fell from the consideration of his happiness to tracing prospects in the live coals, and to thinking, as they broke and changed, of the principal vicissitudes and separations that had marked my life. I hadn't seen a coal fire since I had left England 3 years ago, though many a wood fire I'd watched as it crumbled into hoary ashes and mingled with the feathery heap upon the hearth, which not inaptly figured to me in my despondency my own dead hopes. I could think of the past now gravely, but not bitterly, and could contemplate the future in a brave spirit. Home, in its best sense, was for me no more. She in whom I might have inspired a dearer love, I had taught to be my sister. She would marry, and would have new claimants on her tenderness, and in doing it would never know the love for her that had grown up in my heart. It was right that I should pay the forfeit of my headlong passion. What I reaped, I had sown. I was thinking, and had I truly disciplined my heart to this, and could I resolutely bear it, and calmly hold the place in her home which she had calmly held in mine, when I found my eyes resting on a countenance that might have arisen out of the fire in its association with my early remembrances. Little Mr. Chillip, the doctor, to whose good offices I was indebted in the very first chapter of this history, sat reading a newspaper in the shadow of an opposite corner. He was tolerably stricken in years by this time, but being a mild, meek, calm little man had worn so easily that I thought he looked at that moment just as he might have looked when he sat in our parlour waiting for me to be born. Mr. Chillip had left Blunderstone 6 or 7 years ago, and I'd never seen him since. He sat placidly perusing the newspaper, with his little head on one side and a glass of warm sherry negus at his elbow. He was so extremely conciliatory in his manner that he seemed to apologise to the very newspaper for taking the liberty of reading it. I walked up to where he was sitting and said, "How do you do, Mr. Chillip?" He was greatly fluttered by this unexpected address from a stranger, and replied in his slow way, "I thank you, sir. You're very good. Thank you, sir. I hope you are well."
"You don't remember me?" said I.
"Well, sir," returned Mr. Chillip, smiling very meekly and shaking his head as he surveyed me, "I have a kind of an impression that something in your countenance is familiar to me, sir, but I couldn't lay my hand upon your name, really."
"And yet you knew it long before I knew it myself," I returned.
"Did I indeed, sir?" said Mr. Chillip. "Is it possible that I had the honour, sir, of officiating when—"
"Yes," said I.
"Dear me," cried Mr. Chillip, "but no doubt you are a good deal changed since then, sir."
"Probably," said I.
"Well, sir," observed Mr. Chillip, "I hope you'll excuse me if I am compelled to ask the favour of your name."
On my telling him my name, he was really moved. He quite shook hands with me, which was a violent proceeding for him, his usual course being to slide a tepid little fish slice an inch or two in advance of his hip, and evince the greatest discomposure when anybody grappled with it. Even now he put his hand in his coat pocket as soon as he could disengage it, and seemed relieved when he'd got it safe back.
"Dear me," said Mr. Chillip,
surveying me with his head on one side, "and it's Mr. Copperfield, is it?
Well, sir, I think I should have known you if I'd taken the liberty of looking more closely at you. There's a strong resemblance between you and your poor father, sir."
"I never had the happiness of seeing my father," I observed.
"Very true, sir," said Mr. Chillip in a soothing tone, "and very much to be deplored it was on all accounts."
"We are not ignorant, sir," said Mr. Chillip, slowly shaking his little head again, "down in our part of the country of your fame."
"There must be great excitement here, sir," said Mr. Chillip, tapping himself on the forehead with his forefinger. "You must find it a trying occupation, sir."
"What is your part of the country now?" I asked, seating myself near him.
"I am established within a few miles of Bury St. Edmunds, sir," said Mr. Chillip. "Mrs. Chillip, coming into a little property in that neighbourhood under her father's will, I bought a practice down there, in which you will be glad to hear I'm doing well. My daughter is growing quite a tall lass now, sir," said Mr. Chillip, giving his little head another little shake. "Her mother let down 2 tucks in her frocks only last week. Such is time, you see, sir." As the little man put his now empty glass to his lips when he made this reflection, I proposed to him to have it refilled, and I would keep him company with another.
"Well, sir," he returned in his slow way, "it's more than I'm accustomed to, but I can't deny myself the pleasure of your conversation. It seems but yesterday that I had the honour of attending you in the measles. You came through them charmingly, sir." I acknowledged this compliment, and ordered the negus, which was soon produced.
"Quite an uncommon dissipation," said Mr. Chillip, stirring it, "but I can't resist so extraordinary an occasion. You have no family, sir?"
I shook my head.
"I was aware that you sustained a bereavement, sir, some time ago," said Mr. Chillip. "I heard it from your father-in-law's sister."
"Very decided character there, sir."
"Why, yes," said I, "decided enough. Where did you see her, Mr. Chillip?"
"Are you not aware, sir," returned Mr. Chillip with his placidest smile, "that your father-in-law is again a neighbour of mine?"
"No,"
said I.
"He is indeed, sir," said Mr. Chillip. "Married a young lady of that part with a very good little property, poor thing. And this action of the brain now, sir, don't you find it fatigue you? Said Mr. Chillip, looking at me like an admiring robin. I waived that question and returned to the Murdstones. I was aware of his being married again. Do you attend the family? I asked. Not regularly. I have been called in, he replied. Strong phrenological development of the organ of firmness in Mr. Murdstone and his sister, sir. I replied with such an expressive look that Mr. Chillip was emboldened by that and the negus together to give his head several short shakes and thoughtfully exclaim, Ah, dear me. We remember old times, Mr. Copperfield. And the brother and sister are pursuing their old course, are they? Said I. Well, sir, replied Mr. Chillip, a medical man, being so much in families, ought to have neither eyes nor ears for anything but his profession. Still, I must say, they are very severe, sir. Both as to this life and the next. The next will be regulated without much reference to them, I dare say, I returned. What are they doing as to this? Mr. Chillip shook his head, stirred his negus, and sipped it. She was a charming woman, sir, he observed in a plaintive manner. The present Mrs. Murdstone. A charming woman indeed, sir, said Mr. Chillip, as amiable, I'm sure, as it was possible to be. Mrs. Chillip's opinion is that her spirit has been entirely broken since her marriage, and that she is all but melancholy mad. And the ladies, observed Mr. Chillip timorously, are great observers, sir. I suppose she was to be subdued and broken to their detestable mould, heaven help her, said I, and she has been. Well, sir, there were violent quarrels at first, I assure you, said Mr. Chillip, but she's quite a shadow now. Would it be considered forward if I was to say to you, sir, in confidence, that since the sister came to help, the brother and sister between them have nearly reduced her to a state of imbecility? I told him I could easily believe it. I have no hesitation in saying, said Mr. Chillip, fortifying himself with another sip of negus, between you and me, sir, that her mother died of it. Of that tyranny, gloom, and worry have made Mrs. Murdstone nearly imbecile. She was a lively young woman, sir, before marriage, and their gloom and austerity destroyed her. They go about with her now more like her keepers than her husband and sister-in-law. That was Mrs. Chillip's remark to me only last week, and I assure you, sir, the ladies are great observers. Mrs. Chillip herself is a great observer. Does he gloomily profess to be, I'm ashamed to use the word in such association, religious still? I inquired. You anticipate, sir, said Mr. Chillip, his eyelids getting quite red with the unwonted stimulus in which he was indulging. One of Mrs. Chillip's most impressive remarks. Mrs. Chillip, he proceeded in the calmest and slowest manner, quite electrified me by pointing out that Mr. Murdstone sets up an image of himself and calls it the divine nature. You might have knocked me down on the flat of my back, sir, with the feather of a pen, I assure you, when Mrs. Chillip said so. The ladies are great observers, sir. Intuitively, said I to his extreme delight. I'm very happy to receive such support in my opinion, sir, he rejoined. It is not often that I venture to give a non-medical opinion, I assure you. Mr. Murdstone delivers public addresses sometimes, and it is said, in short, sir, it is said by Mrs. Chillip, that the darker tyrant he has lately been, the more ferocious is his doctrine. I believe Mrs. Chillip to be perfectly right, said I. Mrs. Chillip does go so far as to say, pursued the meekest of little men, much encouraged, that what such people miscall their religion is a vent for their bad humours and arrogance. And do you know, I must say, sir, he continued, mildly laying his head on one side, "that I don't find authority for Mr. and Miss Murdstone in the New Testament." "I never find it either," said I. "In the meantime, sir," said Mr. Chillip, "they are much disliked. And as they are very free in consigning everybody who dislikes them to perdition, we really have a good deal of perdition going on in our neighbourhood. However, as Mrs. Chillip says, sir, they undergo a continual punishment, for they are turned inward to feed upon their own hearts, and their own hearts are very bad feeding. Now, sir, about that brain of yours, if you'll excuse my returning to it, don't you expose it to a good deal of excitement, sir?" I found it not difficult, in the excitement of Mr. Chillip's own brain under his potations of negus, to divert his attention from this topic to his own affairs, on which, for the next half hour, he was quite loquacious, giving me to understand, among other pieces of information, that he was then at the Gray's Inn Coffee House to lay his professional evidence before a commission of lunacy, touching the state of mind of a patient who had become deranged from excessive drinking. "And I assure you, sir," he said, "I am extremely nervous on such occasions. I could not support being what is called bullied, sir. It would quite unman me. Do you know, it was some time before I recovered the conduct of that alarming lady on the night of your birth, Mr. Copperfield." I told him that I was going down to my aunt, the Dragon of that night, early in the morning, and that she was one of the most tender-hearted and excellent of women, as he would know full well if he knew her better. The mere notion of the possibility of his ever seeing her again appeared to terrify him. He replied with a small, pale smile, "Is she so indeed, sir?" "Really?" And almost immediately called for a candle and went to bed, as if he were not quite safe anywhere else. He didn't actually stagger under the negus, but I should think his placid little pulse must have made two or three more beats in a minute than it had done since the great night of my aunt's disappointment when she struck at him with her bonnet. Thoroughly tired, I went to bed too at midnight. Passed the next day on the Dover coach, burst safe and sound into my aunt's old parlour while she was at tea. She wore spectacles now. And was received by her and Mr. Dick and dear old Peggotty, who acted as housekeeper, with open arms and tears of joy. My aunt was mightily amused when we began to talk composedly by my account of my meeting with Mr. Chillip, and of his holding her in such dread remembrance. And both she and Peggotty had a great deal to say about my poor mother's second husband, and that murdering woman of a sister, on whom I think no pain or penalty would have induced my aunt to bestow any Christian or proper name, or any other designation. Chapter 60. Agnes. My aunt and I, when we were left alone, talked far into the night. How the emigrants never wrote home otherwise than cheerfully and hopefully. How Mr. Micawber had actually remitted divers small sums of money on account of those pecuniary liabilities in reference to which he had been so businesslike as between man and man. How Janet, returning into my aunt's service when she came back to Dover, had finally carried out her renunciation of mankind by entering into wedlock with a thriving tavern keeper. And how my aunt had finally set her seal on the same great principle by aiding and abetting the bride and crowning the marriage ceremony with her presence were among our topics, already more or less familiar to me through the letters I'd had. Mr. Dick, as usual, was not forgotten. My aunt informed me how he incessantly occupied himself in copying everything he could lay his hands on, and kept King Charles I at the respectful distance by that semblance of employment. How it was one of the main joys and rewards of her life that he was free and happy, instead of pining in monotonous restraint, and how, as a novel general conclusion, nobody but she could ever fully know what he was. "And when, Trot," said my aunt, patting the back of my hand as we sat in our old way before the fire, "when are you going over to Canterbury?" "I shall get a horse and ride over tomorrow morning, aunt. Unless you'll go with me." "No, said my aunt in her short, abrupt way. "I mean to stay where I am." "Then I should ride," I said. "I couldn't have come through Canterbury today without stopping if I'd been coming to anyone but her." She was pleased, but answered, "Tut, trot! My old bones would have kept till tomorrow," and softly patted my hand again as I sat looking thoughtfully at the fire. Thoughtfully, for I could not be here once more and so near Agnes without the revival of those regrets with which I had so long been occupied. Softened regrets they might be, teaching me what I'd failed to learn when my younger life was all before me, but not the less regrets. "Oh, trot," I seemed to hear my aunt say once more, and I understood her better now. "Blind, blind, blind." We both kept silence for some minutes. When I raised my eyes, I found that she was steadily observant of me. Perhaps she'd followed the current of my mind, for it seemed to me an easy one to track now, woeful as it had been once. "You will find her father a white-haired old man," said my aunt, "though a better man in all other respects, a reclaimed man. Neither will you find him measuring all human interests and joys and sorrows with his one poor little inch rule now. Trust me, child, such things must shrink very much before they can be measured off in that way."
"Indeed they must," said I.
"You will find her," pursued my aunt, "as good, as beautiful, as earnest, as disinterested as she's always been. If I knew higher praise, trot, I would bestow it on her." There was no higher praise for her, no higher reproach for me. Oh, how had I strayed so far away! "If she trains the young girls whom she has about her to be like herself," said my aunt, earnest even to the filling of her eyes with tears, "heaven knows her life will be well employed, useful and happy, as she said that day. How could she be otherwise than useful and happy?" "Has Agnes any—" I was thinking aloud rather than speaking. "Well, hey, any what?" said my aunt sharply.
"Any lover?" said I.
"A score!" cried my aunt, with a kind of indignant pride. "She might have married 20 times, my dear, since you've been gone."
"No doubt," said I, "no doubt.
But has she any lover who is worthy of her? Agnes could care for no other." My aunt sat musing for a little while with her chin upon her hand. Slowly raising her eyes to mine, she said, "I suspect she has an attachment, Trot."
"A prosperous one," said I.
"Trot," returned my aunt gravely, "I can't say. I have no right to tell you even so much. She's never confided it to me, but I suspect it." She looked so attentively and anxiously at me, I even saw her tremble, that I felt now more than ever that she had followed my late thoughts. I summoned all the resolutions I'd made in all those many days and nights and all those many conflicts of my heart. "If it should be so," I began, "and I hope it is—" "I don't know that it is," said my aunt curtly. "You must not be ruled by my suspicions. You must keep them secret. They are very slight, perhaps. I have no right to speak." "If it should be so," I repeated, "Agnes will tell me at her own good time. A sister to whom I have confided so much, aunt, will not be reluctant to confide in me." My aunt withdrew her eyes from mine as slowly as she had turned them upon me, and covered them thoughtfully with her hand. By and by she put her other hand on my shoulder, and so we both sat, looking into the past without saying another word, until we parted for the night. I rode away early in the morning for the scene of my old school days. I cannot say that I was yet quite happy in the hope that I was gaining a victory over myself, even in the prospect of so soon looking on her face again. The well-remembered ground was soon traversed, and I came into the quiet streets where every stone was a boy's book to me. I went on foot to the old house,
and went away with a heart too full to enter. I returned, and looking as I passed through the bow window of the turret room where first Uriah Heep and afterwards Mr. Micawber had been wont to sit, saw that it was a little parlour now, and that there was no office. Otherwise the staid old house was, as to its cleanliness and order, still just as it had been when I first saw it. I requested the new maid who admitted me to tell Miss Wickfield that a gentleman who waited on her from a friend abroad was there. And I was shown up the grave old staircase, cautioned of the steps I knew so well, into the unchanged drawing-room. The books that Agnes and I had read together were on their shelves, and the desk where I had laboured at my lessons many a night stood yet at the same old corner of the table. All the little changes that had crept in when the Heaps were there were changed again. Everything was as it used to be in the happy time. I stood in a window and looked across the ancient street at the opposite houses, recalling how I'd watched them on wet afternoons when I first came there, and how I'd used to speculate about the people who appeared at any of the windows, and had followed them with my eyes up and down stairs while women went clicking along the pavement in patterns, and the dull rain fell in slanting lines and poured out of the waterspout yonder and flowed into the road. The feeling with which I used to watch the tramps as they came into the town on those wet evenings at dusk, and limped past with their bundles drooping over their shoulders at the ends of sticks, came freshly back to me, fraught as then with the smell of damp earth and wet leaves and briar, and the sensation of the very airs that blew upon me in my own toilsome journey. The opening of the little door in the panelled wall made me start and turn. Her beautiful, serene eyes met mine as she came towards me. She stopped and laid a hand upon her bosom, and I caught her in my arms. "Agnes, my dear girl, I've come too suddenly upon you." "No, no. I'm so rejoiced to see you, Trotwood." "Dear Agnes, the happiness it is to me to see you once again." I folded her to my heart, and for a little while we were both silent. Presently we sat down side by side, and her angel face was turned upon me with the welcome I had dreamt of waking and sleeping for whole years. She was so true, she was so beautiful, she was so good. I owed her so much gratitude, she was so dear to me, that I could find no utterance for what I felt. I tried to bless her, tried to thank her, tried to tell her, as I'd often done in letters, what an influence she had had upon me. But all my efforts were in vain. My love and joy were dumb. With her own sweet tranquillity, she calmed my agitation, led me back to the time of our parting, spoke to me of Emily, whom she had visited in secret many times, spoke to me tenderly of Dora's grave. With the unerring instinct of her noble heart, she touched the chords of my memory so softly and harmoniously that not one jarred within me. I could listen to the sorrowful, distant music, and desire to shrink from nothing it awoke. How could I, when blended with it all was her dear self, the better angel of my life? "And you, Agnes," I said by and by, "tell me of yourself. You've hardly ever told me of your own life in all this lapse of time." "What should I tell?" she answered, with her radiant smile. "Papa is well. You see us here quiet in our own home, our anxieties set at rest, our home restored to us, and knowing that, dear Trotwood, you know all." "All, Agnes?" said I. She looked at me with some fluttering wonder in her face. "Is there nothing else, sister?" I said. Her colour, which had just now faded, returned and faded again. She smiled, with a quiet sadness, I thought. and shook her head. I'd sought to lead her to what my aunt had hinted at, for, sharply painful to me as it must be to receive that confidence, I was to discipline my heart and do my duty to her. I saw, however, that she was uneasy, and I let it pass. "You have much to do, dear Agnes." "With my school?" she said, looking up again in all her bright composure. "Yes. It's laborious, is it not?" "The labour is so pleasant," she returned, "that it's scarcely grateful in me to call it by that name." "Nothing good is difficult to you," said I. Her colour came and went once more, and once more, as she bent her head, I saw the same sad smile. "You'll wait and see Papa," said Agnes cheerfully, "and pass the day with us. Perhaps you'll sleep in your own room. We always call it yours." I couldn't do that, having promised to ride back to my aunt's at night, but I would pass the day there joyfully. "I must be a prisoner for a little while," said Agnes, "but here are the old books, Trotwood, and the old music." "Even the old flowers are here," said I, looking round, "or the old kinds." "I have found a pleasure," returned Agnes, smiling, "while you have been absent, in keeping everything as it used to be when we were children. For we were very happy then, I think." "Heaven knows we were," said I. "And every little thing that has reminded me of my brother," said Agnes, with her cordial eyes turned cheerfully upon me, "has been a welcome companion. Even this," showing me the basket trifle full of keys still hanging at her side, "seems to jingle a kind of old tune." She smiled again and went out at the door by which she had come. It was for me to guard this sisterly affection with religious care. It was all that I had left myself, and it was a treasure. If I once shook the foundations of the sacred confidence and usage in virtue of which it was given to me, it was lost and could never be recovered. I set this steadily before myself. The better I loved her, the more it behooved me never to forget it. I walked through the streets, and once more seeing my old adversary the butcher, now a constable with his staff hanging up in the shop, went down to look at the place where I'd fought him, and there meditated on Miss Shepherd and the eldest Miss Larkins, and all the idle loves and likings and dislikings of that time. Nothing seemed to have survived that time but Agnes. And she, ever a star above me, was brighter and higher. When I returned, Mr. Wickfield had come home from a garden he had, a couple of miles or so out of the town, where he now employed himself almost every day. I found him as my aunt had described him. We sat down to dinner with some half-dozen little girls, and he seemed but the shadow of his handsome picture on the wall. The tranquillity and peace belonging of old to that quiet ground in my memory pervaded it again. When dinner was done, Mr. Wickfield taking no wine and I desiring none, we went upstairs, where Agnes and her little charges sang and played and worked. After tea the children left us, and we three sat together, talking of the bygone days. "My partner," said Mr. Wickfield, shaking his white head, "has much matter for regret. For deep regret and deep contrition, Trotwood, you well know. But I would not cancel it if it were in my power." I could readily believe that, looking at the face beside him. "I should cancel with it," he pursued, "such patience and devotion, such fidelity, such a child's love as I must not forget, no, even to forget myself." "I understand you, sir," I softly said. "I hold it, I've always held it, in veneration." "But no one knows, not even you," he returned, "how much she's done, how much she's undergone, how hard she's striven. Dear Agnes." She'd put her hand entreatingly on his arm to stop him, and was very, very pale. "Well, well," he said with a sigh, dismissing
as I then saw some trial she had borne or was yet to bear in connection with what my aunt had told me. Well, I've never told you, Trotwood, of her mother. Has anyone? Never, sir. It's not much. No, it was much to suffer. She married me in opposition to her father's wish, and he renounced her. She prayed him to forgive her before my Agnes came into this world. He was a very hard man, and her mother had long been dead. He repulsed her. He broke her heart. Agnes leant upon his shoulder and stole her arm about his neck. She had an affectionate and gentle heart, he said, and it was broken. I knew its tender nature very well. No one could if I didn't. She loved me dearly, but was never happy. She was always labouring in secret under this distress. And being delicate and downcast at the time of his last repulse, for it was not the first by many, pined away and died. She left me Agnes, 2 weeks old. And the grey hair that you recollect me with when you first came. He kissed Agnes on her cheek. My love for my dear child was a diseased love. But my mind was all unhealthy then. I say no more of that. I'm not speaking of myself, Trotwood, but of her mother and of her. If I give you any clue to what I am, or to what I have been, you will unravel it, I know. What Agnes is, I need not say. I've always read something of her poor mother's story and her character, and so I tell it you tonight, when we three are again together after such great changes. I've told it all. His bowed head, and her angel face and filial duty, derived a more pathetic meaning from it than they'd had before. If I'd wanted anything by which to mark this night of our reunion, I should have found it in this. Agnes rose up from her father's side before long, and going softly to her piano, played some of the old airs to which we had often listened in that place. "Have you any intention of going away again?" Agnes asked me as I was standing by. "What does my sister say to that?" "I hope not." "Then I have no such intention, Agnes." "I think you ought not, Trotwood, since you ask me," she said mildly. "Your growing reputation and success enlarge your power of doing good. And if I could spare my brother, with her eyes upon me, perhaps the time could not." "What I am, you've made me, Agnes. You should know best." "I made you, Trotwood?" "Yes, Agnes, my dear girl," I said, bending over her. "I tried to tell you when we met today something that has been in my thoughts since Dora died. You remember when you came down to me in our little room, pointing upward, Agnes?" "Oh, Trotwood," she returned, her eyes filled with tears. "So loving, so confiding, and so young. Can I ever forget?" "As you were then, my sister, I've often thought since you have ever been to me. Ever pointing upward, Agnes. Ever leading me to something better, ever directing me to higher things." She only shook her head. Through her tears I saw the same sad, quiet smile. "And I'm so grateful to you for it, Agnes, so bound to you, that there's no name for the affection of my heart. I want you to know, yet don't know how to tell you, that all my life long I shall look up to you, and be guided by you, as I have been through the darkness that's past. Whatever betides, whatever new ties you may form, whatever changes may come between us, I shall always look to you and love you as I do now and have always done. You will always be my solace and resource, as you have always been. Until I die, my dearest sister, I shall see you always before me, pointing upward. She put her hand in mine and told me she was proud of me and of what I said, although I praised her very far beyond her worth. Then she went on, softly playing, but without removing her eyes from me. "Do you know what I've heard tonight, Agnes?" said I. "Strangely seems to be a part of the feeling with which I regarded you when I saw you first, with which I sat beside you in my rough school days." "You knew I had no mother," she replied with a smile, and felt kindly towards me. "More than that, Agnes, I knew, almost as if I had known this story, that there was something inexplicably gentle and softened surrounding you. Something that might have been sorrowful in someone else, as I can now understand it was, but was not so in you." She softly played on, looking at me still. "Will you laugh at my cherishing such fancies, Agnes?" "No." "Or at my saying that I really believe I felt, even then, that you could be so faithfully affectionate against all discouragement, and never cease to be so until you cease to live? Will you laugh at such a dream?" "Oh, no. Oh, no." For an instant, a distressful shadow crossed her face. But even in the start it gave me, it was gone. And she was playing on and looking at me with her own calm smile. As I rode back in the lonely night, the wind going by me like a restless memory, I thought of this and feared she was not happy. I was not happy, but thus far I had faithfully set the seal upon the past, and thinking of her pointing upward, thought of her as pointing to that sky above me where, in the mystery to come, I might yet love her with a love unknown on earth, and tell her what the strife had been within me when I loved her here.
This ends side 2 of cassette 26 of David Copperfield. Please fast forward to the end before loading cassette 27. Copperfield, cassette 27.
Chapter 61. I am shown two interesting penitents. For a time, at all events until my book should be completed, which would be the work of several months, I took up my abode in my aunt's house at Dover. And there, sitting in the window from which I'd looked out at the moon upon the sea when that roof first gave me shelter, I quietly pursued my task. In pursuance of my intention of referring to my own fictions only when their course should incidentally connect itself with the progress of my story, I do not enter on the aspirations, the delights, anxieties, and triumphs of my art. That I truly devoted myself to it with my strongest earnestness, and bestowed upon it every energy of my soul, I have already said. If the books I've written be of any worth, they will supply the rest. I shall otherwise have written to poor purpose, and the rest will be of interest to no one. Occasionally I went to London, to lose myself in the swarm of life there, or to consult with Traddles on some business point. He'd managed for me in my absence with the soundest judgment, and my worldly affairs were prospering. As my notoriety began to bring upon me an enormous quantity of letters from people of whom I had no knowledge, chiefly about nothing and extremely difficult to answer, I agreed with Traddles to have my name painted up on his door. There the devoted postmen on that beat delivered bushels of letters for me, and there, at intervals, I laboured through them like a Home Secretary of State without the salary. Among this correspondence there dropped in, every now and then, an obliging proposal from one of the numerous outsiders, always lurking about the Commons, to practice under cover of my name, if I would take the necessary steps remaining to make a proctor of myself, and to pay me a percentage on the profits. But I declined these offers, being already aware that there were plenty of such covert practitioners in existence, and considering the Commons quite bad enough without my doing anything to make it worse. The girls had gone home when my name burst into bloom on Traddles' door, and the sharp boy looked all day as if he'd never heard of Sophie shut up in a back room, glancing down from her work into a sooty little strip of garden with a pump in it. But there I always found her, the same bright housewife, often humming her Devonshire ballads when no strange foot was coming up the stairs, and blunting the sharp boy in his official closet with melody. I wondered at first why I so often found Sophie writing in a copybook, and why she always shut it up when I appeared and hurried it into the table drawer. But the secret soon came out. One day Traddles, who had just come home through the drizzling sleet from court, took a paper out of his desk and asked me what I thought of that handwriting. "Oh, don't, Tom!" cried Sophie, who was warming his slippers before the fire. "My dear," returned Tom in a delighted state, "why not? What do you say to that writing, Copperfield?" "It's extraordinarily legal and formal," said I. "I don't think I ever saw such a stiff hand." "Not like a lady's hand, is it?" said Traddles. "A lady's," I repeated. "Bricks and mortar are more like a lady's hand." Traddles broke into a rapturous laugh, and informed me that it was Sophie's writing, that Sophie had vowed and declared he would need a copying clerk soon, and she would be that clerk, that she had acquired this hand from a pattern, and that she could throw off, I forget how many folios an hour. Sophie was very much confused by my being told all this, and said that when Tom was made a judge he wouldn't be so ready to proclaim it, which Tom denied, averring that he should always be equally proud of it under all circumstances. "What a thoroughly good and charming wife she is, my dear Traddles," said I, when she'd gone away laughing. "My dear Copperfield," returned Traddles, "she is, without any exception, the dearest girl. The way she manages this place, her punctuality, domestic knowledge, economy and order, her cheerfulness, Copperfield. Indeed, you have reason to commend her," I returned. "You are a happy fellow. I believe you make yourselves and each other two of the happiest people in the world." "I'm sure we are two of the happiest people," returned Traddles. "I admit that, at all events. Bless my soul, when I see her getting up by candlelight on these dark mornings, busying herself in the day's arrangements, going out to market before the clerks come into the inn, caring for no weather, devising the most capital little dinners out of the plainest materials, making puddings and pies, keeping everything in its right place, always so neat and ornamental herself, sitting up at night with me if it's ever so late, sweet-tempered and encouraging always, and all for me. I positively sometimes can't believe it, Copperfield." He was tender of the very slippers she'd been warming as he put them on and stretched his feet enjoyingly upon the fender. "I positively sometimes can't believe it," said Traddles. "Then our pleasures, dear me, they are inexpensive, but they're quite wonderful. When we're at home here of an evening and shut the outer door and draw these curtains, which she made, where could we be more snug? When it's fine, and we go out for a walk in the evening, the streets abound in enjoyment for us. We look into the glittering windows of the jewellers' shops, and I show Sophie which of the diamond-eyed serpents, coiled up on white satin rising grounds, I would give her if I could afford it, and Sophie shows me which of the gold watches that are capped and jewelled and engine-turned and possessed of the horizontal lever escape movement and all sorts of things she would buy for me if she could afford it, and we pick out the spoons and